This research that you've done, so what new information have you found about gibbons and siamangs?
Yeah, so my research looked at sexual dimorphism, so that's sex differences in the skull and canines of 8 gibbon and siamang species. And I essentially found that out of these 8, 3 gibbon and siamang species show sex differences in their skull and canine. So these kind of show that there's differences in, you know, these 3 specific gibbon species compared to the other 5. And yet we're still trying to figure out what those differences are.
And how exactly did you find this?
Yeah, so I went to museums all around the world and I collected 3D scans of gibbon and siamang skulls. And then I was able to take measurements from these skulls, from these 3D models, and based on this kind of quantitative analysis, I was able to find these sex differences in both size and shape.
So I understand that there's evidence of similar physical traits being influenced by competition between males in other species like gorilla and orangutan. So why did it take so long for it to be discovered in these species of ape?
Yeah, so for a long time now, a lot of people have known that male gibbons and siamangs are slightly bigger than females, but not very much attention was placed on this. Gibbons and siamangs are known as being monogamous or pair bonded, which means that the males aren't thought to compete very intensely for access to females. And so nobody really thought that there might be some kind of complex behaviors going on in these gibbon species that might mean that the males are slightly bigger than females or might have these slightly more enhanced traits. And so it wasn't until we went and really looked at fine details in the skull that we found these kind of differences between males and females. But it was essentially because nobody really kind of thought to look at them because they just thought there was nothing really to see there.
And so what made you decide to take this sort of research path and to investigate that?
Yeah, sure. Well, gibbons and siamangs are just really cool species. And I just kind of wanted to know more about their biology. But also they've been quite neglected in kind of biological anthropology research. A lot of people put a lot of emphasis on the great apes, so chimpanzees, gorillas and orangutans. A lot of research has been placed on them. And I just thought it would be good to kind of balance out the literature by putting a bit more emphasis on figuring out what the sex differences are in gibbons and siamangs.
And so what kind of benefits do these physical traits give the males?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Because gibbons live very high up in the canopy, it's very hard to study their behavior directly. So we don't know firsthand from direct evidence, but we can tentatively speculate that because gibbons and siamang are territorial, it could be that the male is trying to protect that territory from other intruding males, particularly in the context of mate guarding. So that male wants the access to the female within that territory, so he'll be a bit larger to ward off those other males. Or the other thing is that he might be trying to ward off the males to protect his infant from the male potentially committing infanticide.
So what traits specifically are we looking at in the males?
Yeah, so canine crown height is one, so the size of the canine. And so gibbons and siamang, they're not meat eaters. They eat mostly fruit and vegetation. And so we know that their large canines aren't to do with used for hunting or anything. So we know that they're a social signal. And so in the males, the slightly bigger canine size is associated with a threat of aggression. So if a male sees another male with very large canines, he'll know not to go and try and attack that male. Another trait is the brow ridge. So that's the bony region above the eyes. And so we still don't really know how or why brow ridge differences may be associated with aggression, but we do know that all kind of aggressive encounters start with a stare, and so it's very likely that this kind of prominent brow ridge is associated with a signal of aggression or a signal to not come near me and basically to avoid a fight happening in the first place, which is not good for anyone.
Okay, so then how can we relate this back to our human ancestors?
Yeah, sure. So in our human ancestors, the only real evidence we have is the fossil record. And so the fossil record consists of, you know, skulls and teeth and things like that. And so the more that we can know about our living relatives, so chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans, and gibbons, as well as other primate species, The more we can find out about our extinct ancestors. And so the way we can do this is by looking at specific facial traits in the skull of these species. And because we know what their behavior is, because they're living today, we can go and observe them in the wild. If we can kind of make these kind of tentative links between aspects of skull morphology and their behavior, if we see these same traits in the fossil record, we can then infer that, okay, this species may have been acting in this sort of way because we see those skeletal traits. There's still a lot of work to be done in this kind of area, but it's something that's emerging at the moment. In the next 5 to 10 years, we should be able to make much more kind of detailed inferences about, you know, what our direct ancestors were doing, you know, 2 to 4 million years ago.
And so why does this matter? Why should we be worrying about what our human ancestors were doing all those years ago?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's important just for our own evolutionary history to know where we came from and kind of the backdrop of us emerging as Homo sapiens. And in particular, we had Australopithecus ancestors that emerged around 4 million years ago and persisted until around 2 million years ago, up until our own genus Homo came about. And so it's really interesting to know, you know, what those really ancient ancestors were doing, whether they were kind of living in these more pair bonded societies where the male kind of provides for the offspring, or maybe they were living in kind of more harem like structures where you had one male and a number of females he was mating with. We do know that at some point in our evolutionary history, we transitioned to this more pair bonded behavior that we see today with monogamy and, you know, one male and one female looking after their offspring. But it's really kind of, to me, it's very fascinating to know at what point in our evolutionary history this kind of social behavior, differences in social behavior emerged. And so I think the more details we can get about when and how that emerged, the more insights it gives us into what it is to be human.
Right, wonderful. Thank you so much for coming along to the interview.